So shalom everyone. Welcome to Partners for Progressive Israel One State, Two State, Green State, Blue State series. This is the first of three calls we're going to host about essentially to provide different perspectives on the future of the two-state solution. Partners for Progressive Israel depends on your support. Though participation in this program is free, we kindly ask that you give a suggested donation of $5 or whatever you can afford. Today we're speaking with Nomi Chazan. I think most of you know Nomi, know her well, but I'm going to introduce her anyway. Nomi Chazan is a former Israeli Knesset deputy speaker and leading civil rights and human rights activist. She served as the president of the New Israel Fund from 2008 to 2012. She's a professor emerita of political science and African studies at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem, and has been a visiting professor of government at Harvard University and a fellow at the Center for International Studies, MIT. Chazan is currently the dean of the School of Government and Society at the Academic College of Tel Aviv-Jaffa, and the director of the Center for Advancement of Women in the Public Sphere in the Van Leer Institute in Jerusalem. First, a couple of technical issues. All callers have been muted while Nomi and will stay muted as long as Nomi is speaking. When we open the call to questions, you will be able to address Nomi by unmuting yourself. To unmute your call, you need to press star 6 so that we could hear you. Please remember to press star 6 again once you've finished asking your question so that we can reduce the background noise. Nomi, the stage is yours.
Thank you. Can everybody hear me?
I think so. I think so, okay. But everybody's muted, so
okay.
We can't hear them.
Well, here it's evening, but I understand it's lunchtime in the United States. So hello, everyone, and thank you for coming on this call. I was asked to speak for about 10, 15 minutes, and leave the floor open for a lot of discussion. So let me start with a number of observations which I think prompted this series. The first observation is that wherever one looks, from whatever perspective one comes, there's a great deal of dissatisfaction with the status quo. And obviously, the more one moves left on the political spectrum, there's a greater understanding, realization that the status quo is simply untenable. It absolutely violates the rights of Palestinians as individuals and as a collective. And it puts Israel and Israelis in a situation of being an occupier that who unquestionably is complicit in denying another people their rights. So the status quo is extremely problematic. And perhaps there are some people further to the center and the right of the political spectrum that think that the status quo is the lesser of all evils at the moment. But even they understand that it is extremely fluid by definition and it cannot be sustained over time, which means that one is constantly looking for alternatives. And alternatives that are lasting have to take into account that two peoples occupy the land. When I'm saying two peoples occupy the land, the latest demographic statistics show pretty much parity between Palestinians and Jews in the area between the Mediterranean and the Dead Sea, including the Gaza Strip. We're talking about approximately 6.2 million Palestinians and about the same number of Jews. Therefore, nobody is going to go away. And the question is, what kind of political solution can be found that can maintain some level of coexistence in the area and also give enough room for the expression and articulation of the aspirations of both peoples. Now, this problem is not new, by the way. It's essentially been with us since before 1948, but with much greater urgency since 1967, and we're about to come, we're very close in a year and a half to 50 years of the occupation, because the entire territory at the moment is under Israeli control. And therefore, Israel has to decide to a large extent what it does if it doesn't want decisions to be coerced from outside under very difficult circumstances. The problem, as I say, is not new. The urgency is growing because we are fast moving into a third generation of Palestinians living under occupation, and the third generation of Israelis that really have no recollection of what it was like before 67. So this is where we stand today, with a history of several attempts to foster a two-state solution that have not succeeded. And the two-state solution has been much maligned in recent years, especially after the turn of the century, because of the failure of the Oslo process. And many people have begun to conflate, I think incorrectly, the failure of the Oslo process with the failure of the substance of Oslo or its main objective, which was, and in many respects still is, the creation of a viable Palestinian state alongside Israel and the termination of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. As a result, lots of different alternatives have come up. The most fashionable, and by the way, I think the most unimplementable at this juncture, is the one-state solution. I'm not talking at this point about the one-state solution in my introduction, but I'll be happy to answer questions. People claim that essentially this is what exists on the ground, and therefore one has to institutionalize and equalize the relations between Palestinians and Jews and create a one-state reality which is fair. The trouble is that the one-state reality that exists on the ground is as far from fair as one can conceive. It is totally under Israeli control. In the West Bank, it verges on an apartheid-like situation. I know that this term is not popular in the United States, but the amount of separation, unequal and institutionalized separation, is so extensive that it is almost beyond imagination. And to argue for the institutionalization of that situation is essentially to argue for protracted violence until some corrective is introduced. I am of the opinion, although I was also one of the first to publicly come out for a two-state solution, that at the moment the two-state solution and option is the best of all alternatives to the status quo, although it may not be ideal as a first step. It is a necessary first step for any other option. And to debunk it at this stage is essentially to say that one is not willing to make any effort to alter the situation on the ground and to terminate not only the occupation, but also the burdens that come to Israel with continued and pursued occupation over another people. Now, I admit, and I'm sure some of you will immediately pounce, that the two-state solution has been much abused in recent years. In Israel, easily 70% favor a two-state solution. In old polls taken recently among American Jews, we're talking also 70-80% favor a two-state solution. The question is what one means by that. Well, when Benjamin Netanyahu says a two-state solution, he makes it contingent on so many factors that he essentially makes the concept of the two-state solution devoid of any substance. He talks about a two-state solution in which the Palestinians recognize Israel as a Jewish state. That means they comment on the character of the state, that is totally demilitarized, etc., etc., etc. He also talks about a very shrunken two-state. The West Bank and Gaza today are about 22% of the land, and he's talking about Israel controlling up to 50% of that 22%, which makes any discussion of a two-state solution in those terms totally laughable, really. So I am not talking about a two-state solution that has so many qualifiers that it makes it meaningless. If we're talking about a two-state solution, we have to talk about a two-state solution which is based on the 1967 boundaries, the June 4th, 1967 boundaries, which comes up with a real solution to the settlements. If there are any adjustments in these boundaries, they have to be on a swap basis so that 100% of the volume of the territory is maintained in Palestinian hands. Obviously, there have to be security arrangements. Jerusalem must be recognized as the capital of two states, and some equitable solution has to be found to the right of return of the Palestinians, and there are detailed formulae for all of these elements which would make up, excuse me, a real solution on the basis of a notion of two states. Some people, and I consider myself one of those people, feel that the original Oslo topics, settlements, borders, Jerusalem, security, refugees, the five major topics, may not be enough. Maybe one has to discuss also modes of reconciliation and address the question of the nature of a peace agreement. Are we talking about separation? Or are we talking about an open type of two-state solution? I much prefer the latter, and I think that any kind of discussion should perhaps broaden the range of the issues. Most importantly, they have to be regionalized. The topics on the agenda for a real two-state solution are taking place in a totally different context than what existed in the 1990s. And therefore, I would suggest that incorporation of the Arab Peace Initiative by the way, almost 13 years too late, in my opinion, is really very important, although I remind all of us that the Arab Peace Initiative puts the resolution of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict at the forefront of any kind of normalization. So when we're talking about a two-state solution, all the ifs and the buts that are mumbled by some leaders are simply not serious. We have to talk about a serious two-state solution, a lasting and a durable one, which encompasses at least the five major issues, if not more. Now, a second problem that's come up, excuse me, has been the issue of there's no partner, there's nobody to talk to, etc. There is a partner if one wants to talk seriously, and that excuse is no longer viable. And the final issue I want to address is how one does it. Many people claim today that realistically there's so many settlers and settlements that, I'm sorry, it's the first really cold day in Jerusalem. And I'm having trouble with my throat. There is going to be a practical difficulty with any kind of solution. So saying that the two-state solution is not viable because of conditions on the ground, one can say the same and even more for a one-state solution or a confederal solution. And again, I repeat, even a one-state and confederal probably needs to go through a two-state solution. So I would suggest that the practical questions are more an issue of political will than ever anything else. So I think it's important that we entertain alternatives, but I think it's even more important that we realize that we just have to pursue the two-state solution because at the moment it is the fairest and most obvious way to go. And the reason it doesn't exist is because nobody put in the kind of effort that's needed in a systematic and persistent way in the past. I think I'll stop here and let you comment, ask questions, discuss, etc.
Thank you so much, Nomi, for this. Again, if you would like to ask Nomi a question, press star 6. And please remember to press star 6 again once you finish asking your question so that we can reduce background noise. Anyone? I'm sure there are a lot of questions.
Hello?
Hello?
Yes, my question is simply this. It's beautiful if we have a big peace movement and so on, but is there a will of a majority of the Israeli electorate, after all Israel is a formal democracy, that we can make the kind of concessions that would be needed to get some kind of a peace agreement? Or is this all a figment of our imagination?
I don't think it's a figment of imagination. If one polls Israeli citizens individually, this is by far their preferred option. Again, they may define a two-state solution in a way different than the way I defined it. But is this what they want? The answer is yes. Do they believe it's going to happen? Not really. No. There's The majority feel it's not going to happen. And by the way, this kind of thing doesn't happen. It has to be done. It has to be knit together very carefully. But so there's a real discrepancy there has been for years between what Israelis want and what they think is going to happen, which leads immediately to the continuation of your question, who is going to do it? Benjamin Netanyahu isn't. He's not really a two-stater, not in any true sense of the term. But it is a question of political leadership, and there are a sufficient number of leaders that understand that if Israel continues to operate the way it's operating today, within a matter of 5 to 10 years, there will not be a Jewish majority on the land. Israel will not be a democratic state, and Israel will not resemble anything that its founders thought it should look like or that we have known for the past 66, 67 years. In other words, one has to make a big push for leaders to take the helm, to take the reins on this issue. Now, let me just, before I'm sure a lot of you are going to pounce, a fascinating series was broadcast on Israeli television the last few weeks, and discussing Ehud Olmert's peace proposal, which was very real. The only trouble was he was already indicted on charges of corruption, and therefore he couldn't deliver. But the details of what he offered are not far from what is needed to cement a deal. And with all due respect to Ehud Olmert, there are many other people who think the same way. So the question is whether the Israeli electorate will allow itself to deteriorate into a massive, continuous, violent situation in which it exists today, and it will get worse, or whether it will give its vote to somebody or to several parties and people who will pursue the alternative that others have done before and never brought to fruition. That's the question. I like your question.
Nomi, it's Lenny Grob.
Hi.
Hi, Nomi. Nomi, I want to ask about the increasing marginalization and demonization of the left in Israel. What steps do you see to begin the process of rebuilding a strong left, which would increase the possibility that in a new election that another kind of government would be formed?
Lenny, you've got me on my high horse, so I hope you're sitting down drinking a cup of coffee and otherwise listening. The Israeli population, Israeli citizens, are divided down the middle, 50-50, between those who go in the direction that I'm talking about and those who voted for right-wing or for ultra-Orthodox religious parties. Now, the truth of the matter is that the right did not win the last elections. It did not. As a matter of fact, numerically, in absolute terms, the center and the left together won the past elections because one center party, Kudanu, joined the coalition, and Netanyahu has a one-vote majority in the Knesset, and he has and will continue to lose votes if one person is late, gets lost, goes to the toilet, or whatever. In other words, I don't think that the center and the left are as weak as everybody claims. We've developed a myth of the weakness of the peace movement, but the desire for peace, thank you very much, as well as for substantive democracy in Israel, is strong and very clear at this stage. Any elections that transpire can go either way. This has been true in the 2013 elections, once again in the elections that were held at the beginning of 2015, and in any future elections. If there's one difference, it's one thing that could tip the scale in the direction that we're talking about, Lenny, it is going to be the belief that somebody can deliver on the promises in this region and in this country. I don't see the figure at the moment, but I do think that the belief that somebody else can deliver is also dependent on the gradual chipping away of the image of Netanyahu as Mr. Security, because what we're experiencing now is as far from security as one would like, and as I intimated, it's going to get worse, and also, to a large extent, on a feeling of despair and the global economic and political isolation, which is rising all the time. So the elements of change, the basis exists. The actual timing is a question of how much disgust with the present supersedes fear of taking risks.
Thanks, Lenny.
Pleasure.
Hi, can you hear me?
Barely.
Hello, no, can you hear me?
Yes, now yes.
Hi, thank you so much for this conversation. My name is Gilly, and my question is, can you talk a little bit about the future of the collaboration between the Joint List and Meretz, and in general, the left, the Zionist left, and the Arab parties, and your thoughts about Rivlin's idea, the president's, about a one state. I guess he means a one state without Gaza, where everybody enjoys full democratic rights as a vision, and since it seems like we're in a one state reality until proven elsewhere. Proven otherwise. And the last thing is, if you can talk a little bit about, you know, in the United States, we're experiencing the Secretary Kerry about 2 years ago said the window will close in 2 years, and President Obama did not mention two states in the last press conference with Netanyahu. So is there something changing in the American approach, and would that... Is that hurt in Israel? Is that going to change anything? Thank you.
Okay, that's three different questions you ask, Edie, so I'll take them in order. There is cooperation between Meretz and segments of the Joint List. Okay, not all of the Joint List, and the Joint List is as joint as its components want it to be. At any given moment, there is definitely a constant friction between Chadash and Baghdad, for example, and between all of these and the Islamic movement or the... But having said that, there's constant cooperation. If you take the trouble to look at Knesset votes on these types of issues, you will see you're almost always getting 16, 17, 18, 19, which are merits votes and joint list votes on a critical question. So there's a fair amount of cooperation. If you're looking for a merger, I don't see a merger happening. And I think too much effort has been put into creating mergers when what's probably needed is a form of electoral alliances that will be able to bring in people at various stages. So there is cooperation. Much more importantly, there's grassroots cooperation. There, a lot of effort is being devoted now by a variety of grassroots coalitions and civil society organizations to issues related to the struggle against racism in Israel, to issues related to creating the basis for a tenable shared society. And these are very important. They feed into each other. They also, by the way, have a lot of pushback from very ultra-right-wing groups that have become increasingly racist or fascist or a mixture of both. So there's a lot of work on the ground on these issues. That's to your first question. Your second question about the President Rivlin. Look, President Rivlin is a true Democrat, but he's also a nationalist on the issues that we're discussing. And therefore, he tends to want to promote a greater land of Israel with a liberal cast or image. At the moment, he spent 80% of his time doing something that I consider be terribly important, and that is fighting discrimination and prejudice and intolerance within Israel. But does that mean that it's going to happen? And where are the Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza in this picture? So far, they haven't been incorporated into any of these efforts in a serious way. Not only that, but the amount of contact between Palestinians and Israelis is negligible. It's less today than at any previous time that I remember since the Six-Day War. And that's saying a lot, partly because Palestinians won't cooperate with Israelis because they consider such cooperation to be normalization. So, Gide, many people say that it's a two-state reality, but I took great pains, and I have to repeat what I said in my introduction. The one-state reality that sort of exists is totally unequal. It's totally under Israeli control. It leaves no room for maneuverability. In many instances, not even for physical mobility for Palestinians. So this sort of one-state reality that exists is based on notions of separation. In other words, it might be much easier to split up into two states than to try and equalize a really totally impossible in human rights and civil rights terms situation that exists today. And that's your second question. And to continue on to your third question, which related to Obama and two states and what he said and what he didn't say. Look, the United States did not handle the last few years in our region and in this conflict very well, to put it bluntly. But I think what you're hearing in the United States and elsewhere is simply disgust with the Israeli position, with Israeli inaction, alongside a much greater tendency to be more explicit than ever before about the illegitimacy and illegality of settlements, the impossibility of control over another people against their will, about the damage that is done to human beings and to democracy, Israel's democracy, by the continuation of these patterns. And the United States may, or at least this administration may, not want to involve itself in the last year that it has in any major initiative, but that doesn't mean that it will not join other initiatives should these develop, or that it won't withdraw its automatic veto if necessary, because nothing will bring about any kind of solution. One state, two state, confederal, one land, two people, which is also a variation on the two-state solution, all of these options without significant international involvement. And I think many Israelis are living in a bubble from that perspective and thinking that one can continue as if there are no problems with impunity and nothing will happen. Well, it won't. And that's my answer to your third question.
Thank you.
Hello?
Hey, Naomi?
Hello.
Yeah, hi. My name is Josh. I have a question about the security environment. What's the feeling on among average Israelis about how the Netanyahu government is handling the security situation right now? And then secondly, how do you think that Yitzhak Herzog is handling his control of the opposition leader position?
Again, two totally different questions.
Sorry.
That's okay. I'll try and deal with them. Look, nobody's very happy with the security situation. Just getting to Jerusalem to get on this call, there was another stabbing today. Almost, a day doesn't pass now without something happening. Molotov cocktail, stabbing, somebody's run over on purpose, etc. This has been going on for a few months. People are edgy. Now, there's some voices in the government that claim that Netanyahu and Yaron, the defense minister, are too weak. They should go in, they should conquer the West Bank, etc. That idea, by the way, appalls the upper echelons of the military in Israel, the IDF, who have actually come out with a series of proposals to ease the oppression of Palestinians, to give more work permits, to allow a greater movement and things of that sort. And there's a big discussion, it's a basic discussion, can one resolve this issue of security through the use of force, or does one have to go back to its roots? And its roots are not necessarily extremist Islamic Islam at all, but rather defiance and resistance, by the way, mostly by individuals. Most of this is not organized at all. It's being done by teenagers, by young women and even older women, etc. Who see absolutely no hope, have no horizon whatsoever, and they're lashing out. And if one wants to solve that, then one has to go back and address the roots of the current security issues, which lie very heavily in the fact that one has not taken seriously the need and the urgency of the need to resolve the Arab-Israeli conflict, and especially the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. So military force is not an answer here. And some of the measures that have been used to clamp down on the Palestinian population, in all probability, like house demolitions, are creating new groups of potential terrorists. So I'll leave it there. These are not simple questions, but they definitely don't have military answers.
Hey, hi, this is Hans.
Hello?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. My name is Chaim Shemshowitz, and the question is, what are the prospects for an imposed two-state solution, and how is it compared to an agreed one? Is it the second best option?
I think there'll be, I don't know what an imposed one is. I assume you mean by international actors or the international community. I assume that's what you mean. Any kind of two-state solution is going to have an element of negotiations, bilateral. Is it achievable without external intervention? I would say at this stage, no. It could have been maybe 10, 15 years ago. I don't think that's possible today. I want to be very much Jewish in the next sentence and ask you a question, and that is, does it really matter how it comes about as long as it is dealt with? There's one thing that I would say. I by the way, again, I think it's going to be a mixture of international involvement and some kind of negotiations. And here time is running out because Abu Mazen isn't getting any younger. There's one thing I want to take out of the equation. We haven't discussed it in this conversation, and that's unilateral measures. Oftentimes Israelis, when they don't know what to do, talk about unilateral measures. Israel withdraw from Area A and B, keep Area C, which, by the way, is 60% of the West Bank, 6-0. I think we have very bad experience with unilateral moves, and they are exactly the opposite of what you're talking about, of either negotiations or a degree of external compulsion, because unilateral moves mean one side takes action, there is no transfer of power, it creates political vacuum, as we saw in Gaza, and anarchy, which is like an open invitation for extremists to take over. And therefore, I want to take off the table unilateral measures. I think they're extraordinarily problematic, and keep on the table some mixture of what you're talking about.
Hello?
Yes.
My name is Joan. I have a question which is something of a follow-up to that. If two-state solution is going to require some combination of negotiation and external cajoling, support, persuasion, arm twisting, whatever.
Guarantees too.
Yeah.
That's
right. Could you possibly talk about what the prospects are after the U.S. election? I find it hard to believe that any Republican administration would support movement toward a two-state solution right now, and I'm curious to know what you think of Peter Beinart's assessment of Hillary Clinton's position.
You're one step ahead of me on that. I didn't read Peter's assessment.
Oh, I'm sorry. He actually, his op-ed piece, he evaluates her as being far more in sympathy with Netanyahu than President Obama, and far less likely to challenge him.
That's a very convenient position to be in a year before the elections. Look, the answer to your question is I think, in the question itself. Part of the answer after the elections is going to be who wins, right? Now, if there's a Democratic administration, there will be some movement, I think, even if Hillary, I assume it's going to be Hillary, but one never knows in American politics. You have an amazing tendency to produce candidates that the rest of us from afar look on with a certain amount of, let's put it this way, astonishment. I think something else is happening, and one has to take this into account, not only on matters related to Israel-Palestine or Israeli-Arab relations, but generally in terms of global patterns. What's happened in recent years is that the United States is not the only actor. And its non-involvement in certain areas, or its half-hearted involvement on certain topics, it doesn't mean that somebody else is not going to enter into that vacuum. I think one of the most intriguing things of that is going on today is the increased Russian involvement in the region. The Europeans have always played a role in the Arab-Israeli conflict. In many respects, they're playing a greater role today than they have in the past, because they're taking certain initiatives that an American president cannot do for a variety of domestic reasons. So I think it's important to start thinking not only in terms of the United States as the sole international actor, but in terms of coalitions. And just to press home that point, representatives of the quartet, which everybody thought was defunct, arrived in Israel today to look into possibilities of moving forward. So we're not going to get independent U.S. action now. It's going to be within other frameworks. Hello?
Other question? Do we have other questions? Anybody else want to ask a question? Okay.
Hi, my name is Shalom, and I have so many questions. One is from the Palestinian side. How open is that side to negotiations. We on the left tend essentially to see Netanyahu as a block to all realistic negotiations, and you said so. What about the Palestinian side? Is there a yes there if in fact reasonable propositions or proposals were made? The other question I have is something you just alluded to, and that is the regional issue. The region seems to be falling apart. Is there any chance within a situation of complete chaos to create something reasonable within the Israeli Palestinian scene?
I'll take the second question first. Look, the volatility or fluidity in the region has become one of the best excuses to do nothing. Really, how can you make agreements now when everything is falling apart, one doesn't know exactly even what the shape of the states, who's in charge, who's not in charge, etc., etc.? It's one of the best excuses. Many observers, myself included, think that actually some kind of Palestinian-Israeli accord is a key to stabilization in the region as well. So one could, and I would argue very strongly, should take the regional issue and look at it from that perspective. And from that perspective, actually, the fluidity in the region should be an impetus and not a hindrance. So that's for your second question. Your first question relates to Palestinian motives. And look, it's very easy to say they don't want to, they refuse to, etc., etc. Netanyahu always offers to negotiate, but then he adds his preconditions, his non-preconditions. The Palestinians will respond, or the Palestinian Authority will respond to serious offers made by Israel and to foresee their response and therefore not do anything is the worst mistake we can make at this juncture. If we have serious proposals, put them on the table, and I believe there will be partners. Nobody is enjoying the continuation of the present situation.
Somebody must be enjoying it because they're maintaining it. I mean,
some people are enjoying it, perhaps, but the benefits for everyone involved, if there are any, are very short-term indeed.
I just wanted to return the compliment to you and say, Gamatem, we're not the only ones who choose incredibly poor leadership.
I didn't say you do. I say you sometimes have candidates. I was very, very, very careful.
Anyways, I thank you so much for what you do, and I wish you had, more strength and more reach than you have. A very brave woman. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
So allow me to echo this. Thank you so much for a wonderful conversation that was truly educational and enlightening. Again, Partners for Progressive Israel depends on your support. though the participation in this program is free, we kindly ask that you give us a small donation that will show an appreciation. Next week, December 10, we will host a Vroom Borg in our series, One State, Two States, Green State, Blue State. Please join us. And thank you again, Nomi.
My pleasure. All the best in the Chanukah Sameach next week.
Chanukah Sameach.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you.